There you go. Here you go.
Thanks.
So we have a little basket we'll pass around. We're suggesting a $5 to $20 donation. If you can help, if you want to make a check, make it to the Resource Center or RCMV.
If there is a check, it's going to be to Global Exchange.
Not tonight.
ARC?
Because we'll send the check.
Oh, yeah, okay.
It's local economy. So we'll send this around. If you can help, please support these kinds of events. Thank you.
Yeah, sorry.
That's right. That's what friends are for.
So I got a question.
Party.
Yeah.
I was wondering when Obama visited Cairo and made a speech in Cairo, how it impacted you and did it impact the revolution you started?
First of all, the speech itself, it was a result of work that we have been doing in Washington. Myself, Dr. Saad Eddine Ibrahim, and Dina Gerges, and it was made with the National Security Council. There were people in the National Security Council that were in direct collaboration about adding these points. So these, the points from the fourth point to the seventh point, they were added to the original speech, and they were made in such a way. And that's why this speech was actually very nice. And it seemed like it can satisfy everybody. So the first part, the first 3 points would satisfy, let's say, dictators a little bit, and the rest would satisfy the rights groups and all that, which was nice a little bit at the time, and then nothing afterwards. So it was only a speech. There was nothing at all. Maybe somebody can help me with choosing.
Over here.
With the military in power at this time,
yes.
How is it possible that Mubarak is on trial? Who is the authority that oversees this courtroom? Who's going to make a decision?
Okay, we have a proverb that is a little funny in Arabic, which is, hit your friend if the attackers are many. Do you understand?
No.
Like now I'm with this guy. Okay, we're buddies. Yeah? And you are all coming to attack us. So if I wanna save myself, what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna beat him up like you! Come on guys! Okay, sorry. Look, there was a second phase of the revolution, and the only way to try to defuse it for the SCAF was to bring a big sacrifice to the slaughter. That had to be Mubarak, because we couldn't satisfy with less. So it had to be Mubarak and the key persons in his government. That's why we got him into trial. It wasn't the military, it was the people of the uprising. The revolution that started on July 8th. The second revolution that started on July 8th.
Yeah.
What do you think about the early elections?
The SCAF...
First of all, explain what they are. Not everybody knows what the early elections are.
It's supposed to be an election to make like a new parliament and then a new a presidency. But the thing is, the SCAF, or the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, which is this military leadership in the country that is trying to cling to power, they would never make an election if they are not sure that they are going to rig it. So they have decided that the election will be in September, before, when they thought things were under their control. And then they felt that things are getting out of their control, and then they said October. And then they said November. And now it's been postponed indefinitely. Right now, what they are trying to do is to clean the house first, which means to try to make a witch hunt against all NGOs that may have domestic monitors, so there will be no domestic monitoring of the elections. Meanwhile, they are not allowing the international community to send any international observers. So to limit the possibility of, discovering what they are doing, to the maximum, so that they could get away with it. So it's not going to be an early election. We don't even know when it's going to be.
Yeah, Mark.
It seems to me you've accomplished an enormous amount already. But since
Nasser's time, the army's been in control.
Yeah.
Taking on the army is incomprehensible, I mean, to me.
If the army is in control since Nasser, that doesn't mean we should accept it.
No, I wouldn't accept it.
And of course, of course we have to fight until we are free. This is about freedom. This is what we are all trying to do. We have to be free, we have to have democracy. And there is no freedom or democracy under a military rule whatsoever.
I agree with that. That's not what I'm trying to say.
I think he's giving you a compliment.
It's a backhanded compliment.
Okay.
I mean, you're tilting at a gigantic window. I wish you luck.
Thank you. Yeah, I know. It's hard. Some people know that there was even an attempt of my own assassination just as recent as the 29th of June. Of May, sorry. No, June. Yeah,
June.
Sorry. Mix.
Yeah, in the back row. Yeah,
so
you.
What are the limitations from Americans, and how are they tied to economics in Egypt's revolution?
It's not really this. It's the United States is the country that has the biggest influence on the situation in Egypt, because the United States is the country that gives the military all their technology and weapons and everything, all their toys. So they can control if they want. They have that leverage. And let alone controlling a lot of the rules of the game in the area. So the problem is the United States doesn't want to exercise any influence over the military, and they are happy with the country being handled to their friends. And the generals, because they've been dealing with these guys for a long time, why should they accept a democracy that will bring them unknown faces or people that they would still have to discover and deal with? So that's about this point. About the economy, I'm not really sure. I mean, there isn't really much to say about this point. Yeah.
Yeah, in the back row, you'll be next there.
So strategic. GAP doesn't control big chunks of the regular military because they can't call them out against people.
Yeah.
But those units are not going to go against staff. The units that go against staff. Strategically, how do you move the council out of power gracefully?
We are only able to do this when we can mobilize large numbers of people. That's why they want to deprive us with the large numbers of people by the military, by the trial of Mubarak, and then attack everybody left, because then they are smaller numbers. So our weapon is always in numbers, because we know that they cannot control 90% of the troops. And to make sure that no one will try to make a military coup against them, they keep arresting officers and putting them in military trials. There are dozens of trials of scores of military officers in scores of cases, that because of the fear from the SCAF that the officers are going to conspire against them, because actually many are seriously thinking about that, because they don't accept the corruption of the SCAF. So this is the situation. They can control only certain branches of the military that are brutal branches, like the military police, which is used against the military themselves, so nothing stops them, and some special forces that would do anything because they obey whatever orders they get, even if it means to kill themselves. So, yeah.
First of all,
I'm sorry.
Ed, and then you.
I don't know whether you heard it or not, but Barack Obama went on TV in front of this nation.
Yeah.
Toward the, right after Tahrir had started, and there was huge troubles, obviously, from Mubarak. His regime looked like he was in danger, so. So our president went on the TV and said, Mr. Mubarak, you should establish a dialogue between the citizens of Egypt and the government. Did you hear that? And if so, what did you think?
No, I didn't hear it because we were in Tahrir.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but what I heard afterwards was that there was a statement that came from Hillary Clinton. And actually, I kind of brought this up when I met her. That she said something that meant that she trusts the President Mubarak and his government to deal with their domestic disturbances. Something like that. So Hillary Clinton is very good at nodding and diverting the conversation. Unlike Condoleezza Rice, she goes like a hard face and she would be very tense and she would either defend or also go somewhere else, irrelevant to your own question. So that's the difference between the two. But anyway, that's what I hear.
Shabran, thank you for your moral courage in all of this.
Thank you.
Or I should say pragmatic courage. Not so much moral, but pragmatic courage. The military is the answer to whether the revolution is successful, no? And so my question is, what are the positive opportunities that you have vis-a-vis the military? And what are the negative ones? In other words, are there some opportunities for you to get the military to begin to do the right thing?
No.
Okay.
The SCAF had been handpicked by Mubarak and his corrupt elite. They are part of all the crimes, and I'm saying are, not where. They are part of all the crimes that are in the economic nature and ethical, moral nature in the country. And therefore, they know that if there is a chance that this revolution is successful and they are still in Egypt and they don't have immunity, definitely they will be behind bars and they would receive, they would have to pay for their crimes. That's why they try to fight the revolution in every possible way within their power.
Yes, in their structure, yeah.
There are calls for people to go back to the streets, to go back to Tahrir, and I'm sure there will be maybe at least a couple of 100,000 that would answer this call. Now, I don't know what would be the response of the military. The military had been very brutal lately, and I have very interesting videos that show how terrible and brutal they have been. Shooting people and using electrical sticks and beating up and doing everything. And this is what you see in the street, and there are horrific stories of what happened, where the eyes don't see. So it may be getting to be really very bloody and brutal, but I don't know. The problem is that the United States had given a green light to the military to do what they want. So this happened about 3 weeks ago. And we are still suffering because of this.
Is it possible to embarrass the U.S. by publishing in detail the corruption of the staff?
I don't think so.
No.
They don't care. We've been showing evidence of terrible crimes like people getting tortured and people getting killed.
Economic crimes and their involvement.
So economic crimes are useless. I've been begging the administration under Bush and under Obama since 2008 for something very simple. I would tell them, you have such a leverage in your hands that you can use very discreetly and you can help us tremendously. It's all the assets that have been smuggled from Egypt by those people in power. They are in Western banks. And you could just threaten that you are going to take measures because you have resources that can tell you where and how and all that you are going to freeze these assets if they do such, or if they try to do such, or if they try to take this money to put it somewhere else and so on. So you will get them to be scared because they would feel like they are going to lose all the money that they were looting from the country. And this money is a result of an international crime, which is, according to United Nations agreements, if there is money trafficking or money laundering, these are crimes. This is an international crime. Everybody had agreed about this. But now the point is, if they are going to use this to actually, so they didn't want to.
No, you, Ninja. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I just wondered,
with the situation now in Egypt has it affected?
Now there is a very big problem because there was a kind of a reform movement that started in Israel, which was very promising, and this movement had died. The attention of the people in Egypt that was to continue the revolution had been diverted to the crime of the murder of our six military at the border. So this little thing had caused, I think, a lot of negative outcome that I wouldn't be surprised at all if one day some secret document will come out suggesting that there was a secret agreement between the SCAF and somebody in an Israeli government to get rid of that problem over there and get rid of that problem in Egypt and do business as usual. Because we are not going to start war. It's only going to, you know, like mobilize everybody behind the rulers or whatever. So
okay,
it is a problem.
I don't mean to presume what news here people watch. I know this group watches a variety of news that most Americans don't.
Yeah.
But most Americans were told that that was an attack from the Sinai across the border.
Oh, yeah.
So I think you need to
hear
more.
There is an international force which exists in Sinai, which is supposed to supervise everything, all the activity on the borders. This international force has many, even American soldiers. So it's pretty international, and it has many Americans. And they issued a report about the incident. And in their report, they said that they have found no evidence that there was a breach from the Egyptian side to the Israeli side, but an Israeli commando force had breached from the Israeli side into Sinai. And then when they found an Egyptian checkpoint, they opened fire against the Egyptian checkpoint, resulting in the death of the Egyptian military that were in police uniform because they are in a strip C, because Sinai is divided like into three strips. So the strip C, which is on this side, this is supposed to be a strip with no Egyptian military. But Israel knows very well that the central security officers and soldiers who are supposed to look like police are actually military. So it's like, I am kidding you, and yeah, I know you're kidding me. Yeah, but like, we do this like that. So this is, they were attacking them knowing they were military, not police. And we are not talking about them as police. We are talking about them as military, like everybody knows.
So just for fun, how many of you have heard about this report from the international observers on the Sinai border? I don't see a single hand. Anyway, I would wager, were I a wagering man, that this crowd generally knows more about what's going on in the Middle East than most crowds you could find in the United States. Yet, observation from an internationally empowered monitoring agency is not even known in this country.
So I don't understand something. Who killed the Israelis in
That's the question.
That was supposed to be probably some Palestinian terrorist group, but we don't know, of course, what, who. The Israelis, they should know because they killed some of them. But why should they enter our borders and kill our guys?
You know, the,
I mean, they were in uniform in a checkpoint.
There are Palestinian veteran, you know, groups all on that, on the Israeli side of the border as well. So it's not to say that it necessarily was like a black operation or so-called, but the point is, are the nations in the region capable of either creating or manipulating an incident like this to distract from the two social revolutions happening in adjacent countries?
Yes.
And I think it's
in Egypt,
rhetorical question.
In Egypt, we know that the Ministry of the Interior had been infiltrating and controlling several so-called fanatic groups. Not only fanatic groups, but all different movements, political parties. Like after the revolution, lots of documents came out, and you could see reports made by names that are supposed to be members of political parties, recognized or not recognized, political movements, groups, religious groups, the church, like everybody. They had agents everywhere who are not only reporting but doing. So they could, governments could manipulate different forces to create clashes, and they wouldn't care about the victims. But if that serves, you know,
to exercise or maybe abuse the privilege of the host. I think it's been a real setback for the movement in Israel, but it's not the end of it. And many of the people there in the tent movement in the urban areas of Israel have been explicitly saying not to use that as a pretext to attack Gaza.
Yeah.
Because compared to the last time when the attack on Gaza, there was essentially no dissent from Israel either before, during, or after. Already there's dissent in Israel opposing a major attack on Gaza. There's attacks every day, but a major offensive. So, you know, I wouldn't give up any more than we should give up on the Egyptians, even though the forces they face are formidable, and it seems to us almost incomprehensible that any of these social movements will gain the ground they're trying to gain. But I think it's so important that we not abandon them, whether Egyptian or Israeli. Jeff, then Jane, then Jeff. And then we'll take a formal break for people who need to leave.
Well, it's very inspiring to see so many Egyptian people who are motivated by a desire for freedom and, you know, maybe demonstrations and so forth. They had a taste of freedom and they want more. It's incredible how many people can come out. You know, as you said, you can make some progress with numbers. But also through this period, there's been a lot of turmoil just in daily life and the economy.
Yeah.
And all these people who want to come out to the demonstration don't have to eat too.
Exactly.
So how is the effect on the economy? How's that going to affect the future ability of all these people to come out and ask them?
Yeah, of course, there is a problem here about the economy for those people, and this is one thing that we can't do anything about. There is this problem, but there is another problem that we have to get this thing over, or we will be crushed for the rest of our lives. So what can you do? You keep trying, and you keep hoping that some people would be able to continue with the sacrifice, that some people are capable of continuing with the sacrifice, and would continue on this path. But it's a very hard thing, and I know this very well. I know many people have lost their jobs, many people are barely surviving, and many people just manage to get new jobs, and they don't want to lose them. And of course, we have to deal with these facts all the time. That's why the numbers are not as huge as before. Like on the last day when Mubarak was ousted, the people in the street in Cairo alone was around 8 million. And about 5 million of those were around Tahrir. You would see that the people are crowding everything outside Tahrir, like in, you know, streets, like blocks away, because Tahrir is not enough. And I don't know if any of you had seen Tahrir in Cairo. It's a very big place. It's a very, very big place. It really can take a very large number of people. So, yeah, it's. I'm expecting maybe that we can mobilize around a couple of 100,000 people, which is not bad, considering the circumstances. And I think that this will make the moral question for the military about attacking this large number big, and probably they are going to try to defuse this by getting rid of some people beforehand or putting us in some trials. I think that when I go back to Cairo, I will face maybe something already, because my partners and my NGO are being interrogated in state security, and so of course I know that I am the target, so when I get there, I'll be interrogated and probably put in jail for a little while.
Yeah, well, this relates to that, and it seems that phase three, however that long that takes, and it could be a long time, is going to necessitate the sort of underground fomenting of a grassroots movement to educate and to mobilize people. And there will be pockets of people doing that everywhere, and I'm wondering, because the computer technology, the Facebook, the cell phones, all of that plays a role, is
is it your sense that the security apparatus is doing a whole lot of surveillance in that world?
Of course, surveillance is still continuing. After the end of the Mubarak era itself, for a couple of months, I had no surveillance on my cell phones for the first time in years.
Mm-hmm.
But then the surveillance came back. And afterwards, I found out that it's no longer state security, which was kind of the special police for political dissidents, but it's the intelligence, the general intelligence. And this is, of course, this makes sense because it's the army now that is in control. But they are more tough and more professional. So this is just what's going on with this. Yeah.
Ask your question, Jeff. Then.
Yeah. You know, it, I have two questions. One, it's hard for me as an American, having lived overseas and lived in the Middle East, and having seen what I've seen, not to immediately think that the United States of America and our foreign policy, along with the Zionist state of Israel, are very much to blame or are very involved in making this what it is. Now that's one thing.
Making
so
what?
Making the revolution unsuccessful or putting roadblocks, doing provocations, doing black ops. It's just natural for me to assume that because of what I've seen. Not that I have evidence always. And as an American, of course, that's the dilemma that many of us face, is how do we influence our government in the kind of ways we do, which we attempt to do. So that's one thing. So I have a lot of compassion in it, and you know, I think you're extremely brave, and you know I have a lot of admiration for that. And also I think it's a really, really intense, overwhelming situation. But I'm with you if I can do anything. But the other question is, what influence do you think the Libyan revolution, which has now reached a phase with the Dawood,
succeeded?
Do you think that is a positive thing for the Egyptian revolution?
Of course. The more liberated people around, the better it is.
Right.
Absolutely. Freedom is good for everyone.
So because Gaddafi, you know, though he was not a Mubarak, he was very
for example, I had a dissident friend who was a blogger, and he was wanted in Egypt because he posted a video that shows torture in a police station. So out of fear, he went to Libya. So he was arrested in Libya, he was tortured, and then he was released to be put in a house arrest somewhere far away from where his family, he was married, you know, so his wife is in a place and he is in a house arrest somewhere else. And he continued like this for a year under Gaddafi, with no possibility to contact anyone. I had no idea what happened to him because there was no way to have any communication with him until he managed to get out of that house arrest. So they all help each other.
Yeah. So it may be a part.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a fan of NPR and Amy Goodman and so on, but what other sources of news for the Middle East are there that, because obviously I would like to know as much as possible.
Sure. Al Jazeera English.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably.
The Real News had a clip about the attack on the Sinai border and doubts about it. You know, Netanyahu said, we know who did it, we attacked their leadership in Gaza, and then the military spokesman for the Israeli Defense Forces said, we don't know who did it, and we have no evidence that it was anybody from Gaza. But even that blatant contradiction from two, you know, people from Israel doesn't get exposure in the United States. Forget quoting Ahmed or anybody else, Al Jazeera. These are Israeli, the prime minister and the spokesperson for the IDF, in complete contradiction of each other. Now, I want to know, can you retrieve the fortune cookie from dinner? Did you keep that?
I don't know.
So I'm going to ask him to...
It's probably. It had a very interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe in the jacket. Yeah.
Yeah.
I
think it's a good note to end on. We'll have one more question. Yeah, Roland. Sorry.
What does the U.S. government and probably some forces behind it get out of
They always, okay, I have been talking with officials in Washington for quite some years, under Bush and under Obama. And there is one thing that I have found that always is there. There are three types of people that I've been dealing with. One type, which is usually very strong because they've been there forever, and I would call them old school. They live in the polarized past. That means they have to deal with client regimes and they don't want to change what's going on. They like things the way they are and they want to rely on client regimes, and that's it. So don't try to tell them something else. They go crazy. For example, the lady who is... it's not there. But, like, there is this lady, for example, her name is Nicole Champagne. She heads the Egypt and Levant department in the State Department, or the Egypt and Levant office. And I have met her three times before the revolution and one time after the revolution, once under Bush and twice under Obama. I didn't have a single meeting of those three meetings before ending diplomatically, to say the least. They would end very badly, that people would have to come and apologize and try to make peace from the State Department, and they say, we are not all Nicole Champagne. So there is this type. There is another type that believes that the security of Israel is conditioned with the existence of dictatorships around that can be controlled. Freedom is, again, is the best interest of Israel, and interests of Israel are vital and are more important even for some of them than those of the United States. So those ones, they also have this faith, this belief that it's against their belief, it's an abomination or whatever you want to call it, to allow freedom and democracy for us. And they try to fight it as much as possible. And then you will have those who are okay. They simply don't know. And with those, I explain to them the situation. I answer to their questions. And I've been able to convince them about what's really going on. And they have become quite supportive. But this is a very slow process to try to convert so many people, you know, into understanding and knowing and supporting freedom, human rights, and democracy in places like the Middle East or the rest of the world. And this is definitely not the work of one man. It has to be the work of several people and for a long time, because this country, despite everything that we may dislike about it, is a country where there are many different centers of power, and it is a country that has this form of democracy where people vote. So it is a power of, you know, a majority that dictate their decisions. And how can I meet like 500 or so members of the Congress and another 120 or whatever in the Senate? I only met some, but I can't meet hundreds.
Okay, Gora, we'll have the last question.
Hey, thank you so much. Can you talk a little bit about the role of the unions?
Couldn't hear the question.
It was about the role of the unions in the Egyptian awakening.
Okay, our labor unions were all controlled by the government. So there are no unions that exist that can help or support democracy or freedom. But the workers in different places, they have been demanding their rights. And the government had always been tough against them. So when they had their chance, they made simultaneous strikes with the days of the revolution, paralyzing to a great extent everything in the country, which was not only paralyzed because of the curfew, but because of those strikes. And that helped a lot, of course, in the revolution. But it is not in the organized form of unions that are controlling the workers and are directing them to do this or that or boycott this or that.
So it was workers, not the government.
Yeah.
All right, thank you again for coming. Thanks to Ahmed for making
the
time.
Thank you very
much. And, But if those who are able to and want to could help put the room back into disorder after this, and then also he's going back to San Francisco tonight, so we can't stay too long. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I wanted him to paraphrase what the fortune cookie said.
It was about
eating death and.
The danger, no,
the fear of death.
Yeah, the fear, the best way to face fear of is to doing what you are afraid of is the death of fear.
Yeah, the best way to face fear is doing what you're afraid of, and that's the death of fear.
Yeah, exactly.
Very good.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.